and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? It is Monday. We have all made it through another weekend. The temperature wasn't that bad this weekend, though, Riley. It's pleasant.
Yeah, it was very nice here on the East Coast. It wasn't so nice in the rest of the country, though.
Hey, well, I'm not there, so let me be selfish for a minute. Thank God we got a respite. Is that the word I want?
Respite.
A respite. That's it. Yeah, it's spelled respite. You know, why can't people just spell things the way they're supposed to be? A respite from the humidity.
Yes.
Isn't it weird that I said respite and I wasn't even reading it, Riley? Like, you know what I mean? I wasn't even looking at it. It's like a word I don't use in my vocabulary, so I went ahead and said respite. But it's respite from the humidity. It was nice. I did several sets of comedy. Actually,
oh, that's
six.
Right. Where were you?
I was at the Improv, but, you know, I didn't tell anybody because I do that sometimes. I just want to disappear into the
shadows of
a comedy club, you know, where I've spent a good part of my life for the last 20 years and just do what I do without any pressure. Had a good time, man. Had a good time. Did some good spots. It's very nice to do that work and, you know, leave the weekend thinking like, yes.
Did you go to that after party?
No, I did not.
You did not make it.
No, I didn't. Because that to me, that invitation just seemed like an open invite to resentment. For me to go to an after party of some comics that I know were playing at Irving Plaza. Why would I do that? Hey, what's going on? I was just over at the Improv, you know. Crying. No, I didn't go because I don't want to put it that way. Let's say that it was too late for me.
There you go. There's the frame.
Exactly. And I did a late set, and that's actually true. A guy, this cat, Dustin, who runs a show. There's two rooms at the Improv. There's a big room downstairs, a small room upstairs. And Friday and Saturday, I do sort of a late night thing with the guys who are coming up, and he'll throw me a spot on that if I want to go on. And I, you know, when I feel good about myself, I'll go on. And then I feel bad because I'll go on for 20 minutes. I got these young guys who are like, geez, Marin's going on forever.
Whoa.
What'd you do, buddy?
This weekend was taken with packing and getting ready to move.
That's right. You're going to move on Tuesday?
Yeah, I got to move tomorrow. But I'm not missing a day's work.
That's good, man. I mean, this doesn't really happen in prime moving time, the day's work.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, there's so much involved. You know, you have to go close, and you got to make sure this is okay and that's okay.
The worst.
We did the walkthrough yesterday, my daughter and I.
What does that mean, the walk through the new house or the old house?
You walk through the new house, make sure they haven't knocked out a wall before they...
Before you got there?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, wait a minute. Wasn't the structure standing when we bought it?
Yeah. Make sure it hadn't got hit by lightning or a tree that fell or whatever.
I did a walkthrough of the apartment across from mine.
Really?
Well, this woman moved in, and they were just unloading their stuff. And you know when you see that in your apartment, you're like, ooh, can I look in that one?
Uh-oh.
What's going on in that one?
Mine so you went nicer. In and, yeah, yours
I went. I went in there and made the girls nervous, yeah.
you didn't bring them anything?
No, but I didn't know that anyone was moving out. I was sort of like the creepy neighbor guy. He's like, well, if you guys need any help, you know, I'm just right across the hall.
Well, you know, I guess this must be like prime time for moving across America.
Yes.
I don't know about across America. Certainly in the tri-state area, there seems to be everybody knows somebody or is themselves getting ready to move.
It's a horrendous, miserable experience. Years ago, I remember Sam Cedar actually helped me load a truck once. So no matter what criticism I have of Sam Cedar years ago... When I was moving,
he was a nice guy.
Yeah, when I was moving from Manhattan to Queens, that was a million years ago. When I was with my first wife, before I even married her, Sam Cedar actually stepped up to the plate and helped me load a truck, which is big. It's big when a friend helps you move. He owed me for feeding him in San Francisco. That's a long story. You know, Cedar and I go back.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about moving a little later. But I think what's very compelling. Well, wait a minute, Kayla, what's going on, buddy? What'd you do this weekend besides go to Costco and call me up and ask me if I wanted soy milk? Very nice gesture.
Yeah, that was nice.
I am glad that you didn't go ahead and buy a crate of soy milk, because soy milk's one of those weird things where there's a million different kinds, and you know I'm very specific about the kind I drink, and if you would have bought me a crate, I would have to do that thing where it's like, oh, perfect, man, thanks a lot, and just look at this box of soy milk sitting in my kitchen for the next year. but you didn't do that, and I appreciate the gesture.
I figured that would happen, so no.
Oh, good for you.
I passed on the soy milk purchase.
So outside of Costco, what'd you do, anything?
I went to Macy's, bought my... cousin, a nice wedding gift for a bridal shower.
Oh, really? And what would that be? A bread maker? Let me guess, a vase?
You know, I wanted to get that stuff, but I got her a bunch of towels.
Good for
you.
There you
go.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with towels. Even if they're ugly, they'll use them for something.
And apparently, at her bridal shower, she dropped them on the floor accidentally.
With the towels?
Yeah.
What do you mean? But so what?
But they're towels. You're supposed to keep them clean.
Yeah, I know, but you can just wash towels. You can get all judgmental then. I guess you don't care about the towels. They're going to end up on the floor at some point for some reason. I guarantee you. So two protruding pieces of heat-resistant fabric on the underside of the space shuttle are causing enough concern, folks, that astronauts are considering an in-flight repair that would require a space walk. Look forward to that.
Hey.
You know, after pissing a couple people off last week about sort of not getting our facts right about what exactly was wrong with the shuttle, there's still something wrong. We're not happy about it. But apparently the flight director of the 114th shuttle mission said an engineering team of aeroheating specialists are expected to decide whether or not an astronaut should go out into space with a hacksaw and cut this thing off. Can't they call it something else? Can't they call it a super cyber aeronautic saw thingy? A hacksaw. That's it. Just a hacksaw. You know, you got to. It's the old school thing. It's, you know, old reliable.
Look, these heat tiles have always been a problem on this particular generation of shuttles. That seems to be what's going on here. It's a question of gap fillers, which I only thought was a term used in the subways here in New York, because they actually have something called gap fillers here. But this is a gap filler that apparently is about as thick as a credit card. It's a flexible ceramic-coated material, and they're placed between the heat-resistant tiles that cover the shuttle.
Okay, I get it.
Apparently, they're protruding too far out.
Right.
Way beyond the specifications allowed by engineers.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if those heat tiles somehow fall off or if
problems.
There's a problem, it's a serious problem.
That's real bad. That could be a disastrous thing. Not unlike this. Bush intends to exercise rarely used constitutional power to appoint John Bolton as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. This could happen tomorrow. It is anticipated. It will be a temporary appointment that will last through this session of Congress, which is up until January 2007. So it ain't that temporary. It's over a year. Apparently, the fact that no one likes him and he didn't have the support of the Senate will weaken his position in the international community and, I believe, in the national political community.
Well, there are going to be some real big ramifications to this. Bolton can try and do that bull in the china shop routine in the U.N. What he will do is erode not just his own credibility, but America's credibility within the world body, and expect to see the Chinese and the Russians and some of the other larger countries and members of the Security Council start to gang up on the Americans if Bolton comes in there talking about we don't need to be bothered with you.
Right, right.
That's all it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's still, you know, he's a despicable guy, and, you know, he didn't have the approval, and now it's like, it just scares me when a president takes these type of actions where it's like, I don't care how democracy works. I don't care how you people think. It's not important to me. See, I can just do whatever I want, so screw you.
Well, you know what? We're going to talk a little later about Iraq, because that's exactly the same attitude that he's using in Iraq.
Right.
Telling people, we don't care what you think. This is what we want, and we want it done, and it doesn't matter whether your country goes into civil war. It's the same kind of mindset.
Absolutely. And speaking of Iraq-related issues, police arrested, well, it's actually not related, but it is, you know, it would be related under the old framing of the war, which was the war on terror, but now that's been retitled something else.
Yeah.
It's very complicated.
The war on violent extremism.
The global struggle against violent extremism.
Right.
So Nick's war on terror, enter a violent struggle against the global struggle against violent extremism. Can you say bailing?
Yeah.
Here we go. Police arrested another 7 people over the weekend in connection with the July 21st attempted bombing. Now, this is, dig this. Last week, the capture of the 721 cell member Osman Hussein,
a.k.a. Isaac Hamdi.
Yes, they caught him in Rome last week, has led to some very compelling information that came out of him during interrogation. I don't know if he was screaming it. I don't know if he was going, stop, okay? Or I don't know if he just said, oh, look, okay, I'll tell you everything you want to know. Can I just have some pasta? But I will tell you what he said after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio. It's Monday morning. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Morning's Edition.
This is to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Hmm. 19 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio. We're playing a little Chuck D.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you, Chuck D.
Chuck D.
On-air personality here at Air America Radio is, I don't know how old today, but maybe he doesn't want to talk about
born
it.
Born on this day in 19...
Yeah, happy birthday, Chuck.
Happy birthday, Chuck.
I don't know where he is. He's usually listening. Maybe he'll call us and tell us that he got the... You got
shout
the birthday
out.
Greeting. That's right. So here we are. We're getting into this thing. We're getting into this this guy, Osman Hussein, also known as...
Isaac Hamdi or Hamdi Isaac.
Well, yes, so one of the bombers in the botched 721 bombing attempt in England has some very compelling information came out of his mouth. I don't know if it was screaming or crying or what happened over there in Rome, but he was interrogated. He claims he was motivated out of war, not religion. Quote, rather than praying, we had discussions about work, politics, and the war in Iraq, end quote. Apparently, he came up with this scheme with some other of his co-bombers, his co-plotters, in the basement gym. In Notting Hill, a gym. They were working out.
A gymnasium in Notting Hill. That's
dude,
right.
Spot me. I think we should blow up England.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what the hell happened there. He denied links to the attackers of the bombing cell that killed 52 people on the 7th, the Pakistanis. He said he had no connections to bin Laden's group. He said they had no intention of killing, just drawing attention. That one right there leads me to believe that everything out of this guy's mouth is crap.
You know, he sang awful fast, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, this is like beyond a full confession. I mean, it really is, it's amazing. It also amazing and very much in question over in London at this point is how he got out of the country. Remember I said that I thought at least a couple of those bombers had gotten out of the country?
Yeah.
Well, this guy apparently got on the Eurostar, which is the train that runs under the English Channel from London to Paris. Which is supposed to have passports and checkpoints, et cetera, et cetera. He managed to get there to Paris and then go to, from Paris to Rome. What that says is that these bombers are, much like drug dealers, are one step ahead of law enforcement.
I'll tell you what that implies, you know, internationally, and what's scary about that is, you know, and we'll talk a little bit about the technology of all this and about the websites these guys use and about how they stay one step ahead of, you know, the people chasing them or the authorities or the military, you know, technologically. But also what that says is that they've got a way, an underground network of falsifying documents, of being able to pull this stuff off. I mean, as we know here in New York, you know, you can't monitor everything, even when this guy is accused and they might even know who he is. It doesn't seem like this stuff is as easy to manage as we'd like it to be. I don't know if it's because they don't have a database in place. I don't know. But he does say that the reason that these guys did it, they were spurred on by propaganda films, films where they saw women and children killed and exterminated by what they say America, English and American soldiers. These films apparently, you know, got them worked up. And the man who led them and showed them the films was this guy named Mukhtar. And that's who they that this is coming from the captive in Rome, Osman Hussein. Now, this guy, Mukhtar Saad Ibrahim, who was arrested on Friday, is an Ethiopian-born British citizen, and he went to Saudi Arabia in 2003. Now, this is the scary thing about me. They also, intelligence says that this guy, Osman, I keep it, it's a hard name, Osman Hussein, made a phone call to Saudi Arabia hours before he was arrested. And that implies to me that there is a broader network, though they are talking about this as a homegrown threat within England, and the Spanish officials have detached completely, said that they had nothing to do with the bombing Madrid, but the fact that one of these guys trained in Saudi Arabia and he made a phone call to Saudi Arabia really, you know, is a little fishy to me because the Saudi issue, the Saudis' involvement in 9/11, the Saudis' involvement in global terrorism outside of bin Laden being from Saudi Arabia is not really talked about and it is not really addressed by the administration at all because of business dealings.
No, because of business dealings. And, of course, the king, King Fahd, passed away.
Yesterday.
Crown Prince Abdullah virtually, you know, the next minute was named the new king, is named his successor. Now, I don't know if that's going to make any difference in terms of this nexus with Saudi Arabia. We see a nexus with Pakistan, both of whom are our allies. We also see this nexus with East Africa in terms of Somalia, Eritrea, and Ethiopia, where some of these other folks are from. And what I read a long piece about this yesterday in the New York Times in terms of how young Muslims, second-generation Muslims inside Britain have come to this very deep resentment of the British presence in Iraq, the British alliance with the United States on the invasion of Iraq. And what you see is this constant drumbeat. And I think that, you know, there may not be anything else true that this guy told the Italian authorities.
But the Saudi thing.
Yeah. But I do think it's true that there is a simmering resentment among many Muslims inside and outside the Middle East about America's involvement in Iraq. And it goes a lot deeper than just the fact that we invaded or just the fact that they're there fighting an insurgency or whatever. It really, I think, gets to the root of a religious issue that has been ignored over time.
Yeah, well, the Saudi, the King Fahd and the entire Saudi royal family and the ruling monarchy over there is in constant collision and with this Wahhabist, you know, extremist. I mean, there is a type of a jihadi extremism in Saudi Arabia that, you know, sort of trumps almost everything else.
Yeah.
That is very rarely talked about. Talking about nexuses and talking about connections, there's a big concern on behalf of Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon about the connection between Iraq and Iran. I mean, Rumsfeld told Iraqi leaders last week that they would need to be more aggressive in opposing the harmful, his word, meddling of Iran in Iraq's affairs. But, unfortunately for Rumsfeld, Iraq's elected leadership apparently believes that Iraq's long-term welfare will depend on building a strong relationship with Iran, as well as maintaining ties to the U.S. So this is an awkward situation for this administration, which I don't mind much. But this is one of the axis of evil countries, and on a religious level, in terms of theocrats and in terms of government, you know, the Shia are directly, and we've been talking about this for a long time, their headquarters is in Iran, and there's just no way that this wasn't going to become an issue.
Well, yeah, and you're right, Mark. We've been talking about this for months because now kick is starting to get to shove. Donald Rumsfeld is starting to try and tell this Iraqi National Assembly how to do democracy. That's what we're seeing here. Between that and the troop drawdown, which we'll talk about a little bit later, they are trying to say to the Iraqis, this is what you must do. This is how you must conduct yourselves. And the Iraqis are saying, we don't need you to tell us. We'll figure it out for ourselves.
And also, there's the political nature. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the largest political group in the government, was founded in Iran by Abdul Aziz Hakim when he was in exile there in the 80s. I mean, this thing is really unfolding into something very interesting, and obviously the Sunnis in Iraq, not excited.
Not at all.
Not excited. So when we get back, what's George Bush doing? The president, the neocon death cult puppet, where is he going to be as things heat up around the world? I'll tell you in just a second. It's 27 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. In honor of CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
He believes, in fact, these prisoners are treated well. He believes a lot of this talk about abuses, that they're actually been overdone, and that this report by Amnesty International suggesting that, in fact, Guantanamo is a gulag is not true. Chairman Hunter also noted that while the Senate, a couple of different Senate committees are thinking about...
Ed, I'm sorry. It's Candy. I'm going to have to cut you off there. We have some breaking news out of California. I am told that we have a verdict in the Michael Jackson case.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
35 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. The Morning Sedition program will be broadcasting live from the legendary CBGBs in Manhattan this Friday. We have little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos scheduled to appear, plus comedian Jim Gaffigan. Got some live rock music, some free coffee, tons of giveaways. It's this Friday morning at CBGBs at the corner of Bowery and Bleecker from 6 to 9 a.m. This Saturday, folks, if you're in the Seattle area, I will be performing at Giggles Comedy Club in Seattle. That's two shows. You can go to giggles comedy club.com for ticket info. Later in the show, if you're a Bare Naked Ladies fan, Stephen Page, the lead singer of the Canadian rock band, will be with us to perform some of his new solo pieces. doing a little acoustic set. Got a nice email from a guy that said, you know, he listened to John Butler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On our show, went out and he bought the record, said it was the greatest record he's bought in months, and he thanked us for it. And he was asking, you know, when's the next big thing, man? That guy came out of nowhere. I didn't know that guy, and he was he kicked it, man. He certainly did do that, didn't he, Riley?
Well, I mean, he actually brought a drummer in. I mean, he had some great sound coming out of that room.
All right, so let's get into this this Iraq. We discussed a little bit about the Iraq-Iran issue, but now let's talk about the Iraq withdrawal and the troop cuts. I mean, this is now, it's no longer the war on terror, folks. It is the global struggle against violent extremism. The Pentagon has been drafting a plan to scale down the U.S. presence in Iraq to about 80,000 by mid 2006, and down to 40,000 to 60,000 by the end of 2006, or 2000, and is it? Could it be by the end of this year?
Yeah, by the end of 2006, next
no
year.
No kidding.
By the end of today's next year.
Oh, this is 2005. I'm lost along the time. New conditions of the withdrawal no longer include a defeated insurgency. Now, this is interesting.
Say that again, because I want people to hear exactly what you just said.
New conditions for the withdrawal no longer include a defeated insurgency.
Uh-huh.
They now believe the insurgency can be beaten only politically by the success of Iraq's new government. Now, this seems like, do not misunderstand this in terms of you people that were frightened into voting for this president because you thought this was a war on terror as opposed to a war that's creating more terrorists, and now they're saying that they can't even win it, and they're putting it off. This is blame dispersal in the nth degree. They're putting it off on a fragile, you know, kind of chaotic new government, and they're putting it off on a government and a country that's on the verge of civil war, and this is for a lot of reasons. They are trying to get this done before the midterm elections so they can at least send their, you know, Republicans out into the world saying they have some success in Iraq, but any of that is going to be a lie. The only good thing is for the military families and the people within the military who need a break, who need to be taken care of and come back home for at least a little while, can get a little respite from the crap they're going through and the chaos in Iraq, and also, you know, and sort of reassess where they are. But even they're facing some trouble, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But just, you know, understand something, people. You know, I don't care how you spin this, but this is the neocon death cult. This is the U.S. administration admitting defeat on certain levels. You know, this is, you got General Richard B. Meyer, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, last week said at a National Club press club meeting, he said, quote, he objected to the use of the term war on terrorism before, because if you call it a war, then people in uniform as being the solution. He said the threat should instead be defined as violent extremists with the recognition that, quote, terror is the method they use. This is high-level military officials, you know, completely trying to reframe this thing, and Rumsfeld trying to make it look like this is what he wanted all along. But the crux of it is, Riley, is that they are admitting defeat.
Yeah, they are admitting defeat. And let's talk about the timeline here, because the timeline really starts this month. And would end with a troop presence in the U.S., as you mentioned, of between 40 and 60,000 troops by the end of next year. Step number one in the American plan is to force the Iraqis to draft this constitution by the deadline that has been imposed, which is August 15th. In other words, they got 2 weeks from today to finish the constitution. Why is that significant? Because the constitution is still being thrashed out around issues like, for example, women's rights, the issue of the role of Islam in Iraqi life, around the role of the Kurds and what kind of autonomy they're going to have. The U.S. is pressuring the Iraqis to leave all of this stuff out of the Constitution to get the Constitution done on time. Why? Because it's part of this sequence of events that will end with the U.S. troop drawdown.
Yeah, but the bottom line is I've got no indication from where we're sitting that, you know, that the Iraqi National Forces or the Iraqi police are ready to handle this on their own. And clearly by the piece we were just talking about in terms of the connection between Iraq and Iran and the theocratic element of the new government wanting to put some extremely sort of Sharia-like laws within the Constitution is going to be an argument among some of the more secular Muslim members of the government. I mean, this thing can't be rushed unless it's just doing one big publicity campaign, Riley. The only good thing that comes out of this is that some of these guys can come home for a while, some of these men and women and can come home for a while and get some rest and reassess where they're at. But what ultimately happens in Iraq and who's responsible for it, who the hell knows? It seems like we have to take a big part of that responsibility, and all these neocon death cult guys who just pilfered the country, made their friends millions of dollars, and are willing to cut and run now for political reasons is heinous. And it's not unlike Vietnam in a lot of ways.
Well, it's not unlike Vietnam. And again, you go back to this thrashing out of a constitution, because that's what's going on. You've got the Kurds on the one hand. You've got the Shia in the National Assembly. You've got the Sunnis who have been installed, essentially, within the National Assembly. They're all at loggerheads about how to deal with many of these gut bucket issues. And here's the problem that Rumsfeld and his people are facing. If a two-thirds majority of three provinces inside Iraq votes no on this constitution, the constitution fails. Guess who has a majority in three provinces?
The
Kurds.
The Kurds.
The
right.
Kurds have a majority in the three provinces.
This is Riley's. This is your sort of pet cause. Riley's a Kurd guy. You know, he's always been talking about the Kurds since the beginning of this.
Well, yeah, and the reason is the Americans are not just like they sold out the Kurds once before when Saddam Hussein went after him after the Gulf War. They appear to be prepared to sell out the Kurds again. The Kurds' central issue is the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, the fourth largest city in Iraq, and it is a place where Kurds were forcibly removed by Saddam Hussein, and they want their land back.
Yeah, and also the other issues here is the Bush administration not only wants to make this look good for the midterm elections, they want to preempt growing public pressure for withdrawal, which is part of that political movement, and this could also give insurgents a Vietnam-like strategic goal. And on the other side of this, you've got military recruiters who are afraid of driving away Army careerists and recruits if current deployments continue on. It's draining the military of their ability to even recruit people for the military, and it's putting them in a position, and the Pentagon in a position, to, well, they'll have to reinstate a draft. And the question is whether or not, bottom line, whether or not the insurgents will see the U.S. plan as a rush to the doors, and whether they and the Iraqi militias will come to dominate the country in the vacuum left by the U.S. forces, which would mean the civil war would just foment into a nightmare. But again, the neocon death cult has made a fortune. They have made their friends a fortune. On some level, that damage has been done, and they, on some level, they don't care about anything but politics. They have done exactly what they wanted to do. All this other stuff is just dressing to them and crisis management. That's the pathetic thing, and our president went along with this. Just the idea that they're changing the name of this war and admitting defeat on that level should really wake people the hell up, that they've been taken advantage of, that they were bullied into agreeing to this war, and they were bullied into thinking it was the right thing to do, and all it has done is create more terrorists.
A year ago, George W. Bush was asked at the G8 summit in Sea Island, Georgia, exactly when the U.S. troops would get out of Iraq. Let's hear that, if we can. I'm sorry, Chris.
What can you tell the American people about when U.S. troops might be coming home from Iraq in large numbers?
When the job's done.
Well, they've changed that particular frame, haven't they?
That's for sure. Hey, folks, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator to let's crank it up and feed it some headlines, my friends. All right, here we go from the Chicago Times. Bush may sidestep Congress and seat Bolton. Bush may sidestep Congress, seat Bolton. Translation. Bush goes forward with secret bombing of UN.
Okay.
From Seattle Times, Bush, 8 pounds lighter, aces physical exam. Bush, 8 pounds lighter, aces physical exam. A translation, weight loss credited to string of political failures diet. From Reuters. Yeah. From Reuters, silicone breast implants get FDA okay. Silicone breast implants get FDA okay. Translation, silicone breast implants bounce back. We gotta do a couple more of those. Silicone breast implants get FDA okay. Silicone breast implants get high, firm okay. All right, enough of that.
Implants okay, morning after pill. See you later.
We're gonna get into that a little later, just about, you know, where the Democrats are moving with the abortion discussion, debate, framing. A lot of stuff going on that we'd like to get your feedback about. When we come back, it looks like Bush has gone to the doctor. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog.
MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
How many vacations do you think he's taken? George W. Bush, the AWOL ex-blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult. How many do you think he's taken? He's going out there again for a few weeks to the ranch. Well, it's not really a ranch. I call it a ranch, by the way. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. A ranch would be an extensive farm, especially in the western United States, on which large herds of cattle, sheep, or horses are raised. Apparently, all that really goes on out there at Bush's ranch is some, you know, he does some brush clearing. He's raising weeds. 3 weeks. Just keep it in mind, though. How many? How many times do you think? Well, you know, all right, there you go. There's the fax machine. This is it's time for this week's liberal agenda from the Streisand compound, giving us a rundown of all our important liberal causes and marching orders. One, proposed National Slacker Day to celebrate Bush's 50th trip to the ranch in 5 years. It's true. That's a 50th trip. Two, hold seminars to promote tolerance in people who think they can't tolerate the heat. Three, circulate flyer with a chart detailing how many edgy independent films could be made for the price of the space shuttle. Four, suggest slogan for new Al Gore TV network. It's not boring, we promise. Five, phrase of the day, just work it into conversation. I've been watching the London bombing investigation. Apparently, it's possible to catch terrorists without invading a completely unrelated country and taking their oil. Wake up, sheeple. Britain ran its investigation with Sherlock Holmes. We ran ours with lobbyists and bombs. That's why we're not catching Bin Laden until it suits Tom DeLay, people.
Ooh.
All right, that's that, huh? What do you got now? Let's do this thing about, oh, look, if you're in the military, this is a story coming out of Camp Pendleton, specifically out there in California, but many other bases around the country. Service members living off base may take a severe cut in the money allotted to them for living in off-base housing. This is the Basic Allowance for Housing, BAH.
Yes. This is a situation where, for 5 years, people who moved from a relatively expensive place to live to a less expensive place to live still got the housing allowance at the rate of the more expensive place. Well, now, starting today, they will start to get their housing allowance from where they actually are. Now, that may seem like a very fair-minded thing to do, but the fact of the matter is, when it comes to the military and how much they actually make in a month, you're going to see people having trouble making their mortgages cuts.
I think a lot of people do this out of practicality. It's a way of creatively figuring out a way how you can make your nut. You know, if it's your choice, you get a certain allotted amount of money and you know that you can move to another place and still get the same amount of money. It doesn't mean you're taking advantage of everything and anything. It means that you're trying to, you know, live the best life as possible. Apparently, some of these cats are moving, you know, these military service people are moving up to an hour away to try to make ends meet. But the thing that they aren't going to do, I guess, is that they are not going to take the individual rate protection away from these military servicemen, which insulates service members against rising housing costs. That will remain in effect despite the changes in the BAH, as long as service members stay within the same geographic area, which is interesting. I don't know what that encompasses exactly, but apparently this took a lot of people, you know, even people within the military payroll department by surprise that all of a sudden these new rules are going to be pulling money away from people, and it's hard for them to make their nut, just as you said, with housing costs where they're at.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about the military, because remember that in many instances now, stateside military people actually reside not on base housing, but in off-base housing. And as anyone who has done any business in real estate over the last year knows, housing costs all over America are skyrocketing. What is a military guy? Let's say, for example, a master sergeant. What is a master sergeant supposed to do if his basic housing allowance is cut by, let's say, $600 a month? and he's living in a $450,000 home. Now, that sounds like it's real expensive, but in today's real estate market, that's about what he'd have to pay in Southern California, for example.
And the real hinge to this, I think, Riley, in terms of the basic allowance for housing in the military is that it is payable when government quarters are not provided. So I'm assuming in a lot of these cases, they don't have room on the base. So these guys have no choice. So they're taking a hit from the military, and now they're going to be taking a hit from the housing market. And now if they're living outside of the area that they were allotted the original money in, that they were using for this new area, even though it was a little more, they were trying to accommodate these housing costs, they're going to get screwed a little bit. And this is just another example about how, you know, of how this administration really doesn't look out for the military in a way that they should. And there's some people, you know, obviously we speak out against that in terms of health care coverage. But just today, we've got Senator Daniel Inouye
of Hawaii,
who is
a decorated war veteran,
lost his
add.
Arm in yes. World War II. Said Republicans are not doing enough for troops returning from Iraq. He said Republicans are busy focusing on legislation sought by the gun lobby and ignoring the needs of the troops. The Senate put off completion of a $491 billion defense bill to act on the National Rifle Association's needs. Inouye said, quote, for years we've heard the president and congressional Republicans speak eloquently about honoring our troops, but this week, when push came to shove, their priorities were different. Our Congress could consider our men and women in uniform as our nation's top priority. So this is a guy who's a vet, and this alongside of, you know, just what we're seeing in terms of how long these guys are staying in Iraq, how few recruits are actually able to get, how much now they're taking some money away from cats who are service members who are trying to make ends meet by creatively, you know, relocating themselves so they can make a little extra dough, and now they're taking that away.
They're taking that away. They're forcing some service people, you know, it's one thing to force ordinary commuters or workers to travel further to get back and forth to their job. It's something else to ask people we are supposed to be honoring because of their service to us to do the same thing. And it is sad that the National Rifle Association did not say, look, you know what? You need to act on the money for service people first. Instead, they acted on something that was the National Rifle Association's priority.
Really, go figure. A multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry acting on its own interests without caring about people. An industry that is, you know, at least halfway responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of people in this country every few years. Oh, my God, those numbers are unbelievable. So, look, when we come, the number was 50, if you didn't realize it. Bush is going on his 50th trip to the ranch or to the house on the land where there's apparently tumbleweed problems for the 50th time in 5 years. And his physical came back nearly perfect for a guy his age. You know why? Well, if you're taking 50 vacations in 5 years, you know, for at least 3 weeks, and you work out 6 days a week, and you go to bed before 10, and you eat right, and you just completely detach from the problems of the world or the problems of what your job entails and leave that to other people, to the point where you actually say, I don't know about what's going on in the White House. We'll have to wait until the investigation sees it. If you're that detached, man, how can you not be healthy? I wish I could be that detached.
Me too.
Bastards. Anyways, 57 past the hour. We'll talk to you in a second. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and lurking conservatives. You're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
The network is Air America Radio. We were having a conversation before we went away to the break about military bases making housing cuts, not housing cuts, but money cuts at Camp Pendleton and many bases, other bases around the country. Service members living off base may take severe cuts in the money allotted to them for living in off-base housing. And some of this is necessary. Some of the reasons why military service people live off-base is there's no room on the base, and they're allotted money per the housing market of that particular area. Now what they're doing is, it used to be that if you were getting a certain amount of money in one area, you moved to another area that may be a little cheaper, you still got that same amount of money, which would enable you to live a little more comfortably in the housing market that we are now in, which is extremely high. And now they're taking that away. You can't do that anymore. And if you're living in that neighborhood, you know, that used to get more money, and you move into it, there could be guys getting more money than you're going to be getting once you move there. What they're doing basically is they're changing the rules. They're changing the rules, and now a lot of guys in the military are going to take a hit in terms of the money that they're going to be allotted to pay for housing. And in this market, that's a big strain. We got a guy calling from Ohio here. Brian, how are you? You going to tell us a little bit about something else they're cutting back on?
Oh, yeah. This one killed me. My brother just got back from Iraq about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's a platoon sergeant in the Army, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said to his guys over there, what they're doing now, well, everybody, is that it used to be a year tour, a hardship tour. After a year, any time you spend over there, you're supposed to get about $1,000 extra a month on your paycheck. Well,
right.
Now what they're doing is they've extended the tours for everybody to 2 years. And what they do is they ship them out about a year, 2 years, 3 months. So that way they don't have to pay anybody that extra money for keeping them there for over a year.
That is unbelievable. So they're scamming these guys out of a hardship pay that they deserve by extending the amount of time that they deployed for and cutting it short just so they don't have to pay them that money.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Thanks for your call.
I haven't heard anybody talk about it.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, man, that is disturbing. You know, I mean, because we've heard stuff about these guys coming back and getting, you know, limited health care depending on what's wrong with them. Now we've heard this from Brian about his brother, where they've extended this hardship pay to 2 years, and then they deploy these guys for just under that, and they don't get the pay. They don't get the pay that's coming to them. And now we hear this thing about the housing. What they're doing is they're nickeling and diming. They're pinching on the budget, and they're taking it out of, like, the military, out of these vets' pay in all different sorts of ways, and it's just baffling, and it's evil.
Well, see, what they're doing is taking it. These are enlisted people we're talking about. The last caller, his brother was a platoon sergeant. You're talking about E3s, E5s, E7s, people that are in that below officer pay bracket, and the ones that get buffeted about by things like housing costs, by things like what is essentially a bait and switch in you know, promising hardship pay and then bringing people back just before they've done the time to earn it. That is the lowest form of disrespect for the American military that I can think of.
Yeah, and this whole thing that's going on at Camp Pendleton, this elimination of geographic rate protection, apparently the DOD, the Defense Department policy, just was enacted 5 years ago that would allow service members to retain higher housing allowances even when they moved to cheaper neighborhoods. Now that's off the table. And this was not a scam on behalf of the guys who were moving to cheaper neighborhoods. They got families. They got a housing market that's incredibly, it's exorbitant. So they were doing it to, you know, to live reasonable lives. It's just, it's a shame. There's other stuff going on in the world that we want you to know about here at the top of the hour. The space shuttle, two protruding pieces of heat-resistant fabric on the underside of the shuttle are causing enough concern that the astronauts are considering an in-flight repair that would require a spacewalk. So after all this training that they did in terms of repairing in flight, they might actually be taken to task to do that. The flight director of the 114th shuttle mission said an engineering team of aeroheating specialists are expected to decide whether or not an astronaut should go out into space with what tool? A hacksaw.
Ooh.
Can't they call it something else? Can't they put a special handle on it and call it the Interspatial Galactic Hacksaw or something? Why did the guy say just hacksaw? All right, so what else is going on? Let's talk about the guy who was captured in Rome, one of these, one of the members of the cell that did the botched bombing attempt in London. Osman Hussein was captured last Friday in Rome, and as he was interrogated, and had some fairly compelling information coming out of him during interrogation, though I'm not sure I buy most of it. He claims that his cell was motivated out of war, not religion. Apparently the plotters hatched their ideas in a gym. He denied links to the attackers who killed 52 people on the 7th in London. He said they had no connection to Bin Laden's group, though they'd heard of him. Well, that's really, you heard him, Bin Laden. All right, he said that they had no connections to the Pakistanis who were being held in the bombing that killed the 52 people. He said they had no intention of killing, just drawing attention. Now, there's the crux right there, Riley. How can that be true?
I don't know if anything this guy is saying is true. It may well be disinformation, deliberate disinformation, to throw the police off the notion that there is some direct linkage, for example, between themselves. And remember that the July 21st bombers were largely East African Britons or Britons of East African extraction. In the case of this guy, Ethiopian born but British raised. And maybe they're just trying to keep the police, you know, barking up the wrong set of trees here. But you're seeing more and more people getting arrested, it seems, with each passing day in more places. And it's starting to put the British on edge because they're starting to realize that a lot of this is, you know, a homegrown terrorist threat. And there's now a big issue about whether or not police and security forces should be allowed to racially profile. But some of their people in the cabinet say they should be.
It's homegrown to a certain degree, you know, but Riley, I can't see. I just keep getting hung up on this thing. This guy who is, you know, this Osman Hussein, who was captured in Rome, has basically said that they were shown propaganda films that spurred them into action. The man who led them and showed them the films, his name was Mukhtar. And apparently this Mukhtar Said Ibrahim was arrested on Friday. He's an Ethiopian-born Briton. He went to Saudi Arabia in 2003, and he trained there, apparently. He's accused of planting the explosives on the bus in East London during that the botched bombing attack. But this guy was connected to the Saudis. And apparently Osman Hussein, the guy who was captured in Rome, who was interrogated, made a call to Saudi Arabia hours before he was arrested. That implies to me that there is some deeper connection to at least training camps or some Al-Qaeda group or Al-Qaeda-related group in Saudi Arabia. It may not be Osama bin Laden's, but as homegrown as this is a franchise of a broader situation.
Well, yeah, and it's a franchise of a situation that really threatens all of Western Europe if it continues to go on unchecked. And there are now people who are starting to compare the British response to this particular set of terrorist acts to the American response to 9/11, because the British have gotten all these, I believe it's now 21 people, 18 in Britain, 3 in Italy, that are in custody around this terrorist plot or this series of plots.
Well, here's something interesting they didn't do, Riley, that we didn't do here, which apparently someone is doing. One by one, over the past 2 weeks, Al-Qaeda-affiliated websites are vanishing off the Internet. And now, this is a report from Israeli intelligence, and Israeli intelligence is, like, top-notch. I mean, it's either them or the British that have been called top-notch. And apparently, Israeli intelligence thinks it's British intelligence trying to shut down the access of extremist information after the last two attacks on their country. It seems that a plethora of these sites that give urban warfare and bomb-making information have been shut down, but moderate Muslim sites remain, specifically ones that condemn the British bombings. Now, the only site where they can actually get, now apparently in the world of the Internet, the only place you can get fairly reliable, quality bomb-making instructions is radical U.S. militia sites and the Justice Department sites.
So, oh, yeah.
That said, the terrorists will have to take advantage when it comes to... The terrorists will have... Here's the thing about terrorists and technology, or they have an edge on this in terms of... Because a lot of this stuff, we assume that they can monitor and track cell phone usage, but apparently for all of the advances, you know, the tracking of mobile phones, isolating key phrases and conversations, experts believe that current technologies actually play into the hands of the terrorists. Apparently some government-sponsored monitoring systems can track vast amounts of data, but are vulnerable to manipulations like a bunch of guys just chattering and blocking, you know, what I'm saying basically is that the terrorists are, and the people that are plotting, know a lot of tricks, and they're staying one step ahead of our ability to manage the information that we get from them.
Well, yeah, what we see are terrorist techno geeks. I mean, we've got people apparently out here who know how to manipulate the Internet, know how to manipulate computers and cyberspace to the point that they can get their messages across, they can reach people outside the ability of law enforcement to track or apprehend them.
Wow. Look, folks, coming up, we're going to be talking, we're going to have a prolonged conversation with you and ourselves about the framing of the abortion issue, the debate about abortion, and how it is to be approached by Democrats, you know, in the upcoming midterm elections. We've got the job listing coming up. We've got Morning Remembrance coming up.
Uh-oh.
We've got the singer of the Bare Naked Ladies, Mark Benjamin, is doing a solo bit. He's got a record coming out. He's coming up. So I say I would invest some time in this show. It's 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Yeah, good.
Hi, this is Congressman Gerald Nadler from New York's 8th District, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
21 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
My apologies to Mark Benjamin, who is going to, he's actually a writer who's going to be with us tomorrow. Stephen Page was the lead singer of the Canadian rock band, the Bare Naked Ladies. He will be with us today, running by the little list of things. It's like, hey, yeah, Dick Cheney, the lead singer of Megadeth, is going to be, I mean, what is that?
Well, that's not so far removed.
Well, Megadeth. Yeah. Just the, you know, what Megadeth to the title is parodying, he is guilty of, yes. Here we go. Last week, this is our... Last week, the Senate approved longtime Bush buddy Karen Hughes as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy. Her main job is to reverse anti-American sentiment in the world, especially in the Muslim world. And hey, job seeker, she's already advertising for assistance. We found this in a classified ad. It's our morning's edition Monday job listing. Wanted, really, really good PR pros. Do you enjoy a challenge? How about a struggle? How about an exercise in futility? Join us in our quest to sell American values to a world of people who think the key to heaven is to kill as many of us as possible. You will be responsible for a U.S. government program to get people to love us after the rest of the resources of the U.S. government are used to torture them to death with sledgehammer handles and attack dogs. Sorry, but Arab Americans are not encouraged to apply. Too much of a security risk. If it sounds impossible, remember, you will be working for a respected professional woman who helped convince the American people to elect the dimwit who got us into this mess in the first place. There you go. That's Monday's job listing. Folks, we're going to be broadcasting live from CBGB's here in New York City in Manhattan this Friday. That is the legendary CBGB's. We're going to have little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos scheduled to appear with us. Comedian Jim Gaffigan as well. We're going to have some live music, free coffee, tons of giveaways. At 6 to 9 at CBGB's this Friday. And on the Saturday following that, I'll be at Giggles in Seattle, Washington for two shows. August 6th, go to giggles comedy club.com for information and tickets. Now let's get into this. We're going to take your calls in just a second. So start thinking about abortion, about the debate about abortion, about what you call abortion, what the Democrats should do coming up to the midterm elections. With John Roberts almost certainly becoming a Supreme Court justice, how do we approach the abortion debate slash discussion in light of the fact that Roe v. Wade could be overturned? That's looking ahead at the elections of 06 and 08 in terms of how Democrats deal with this issue. There's a conversation that would move the language of abortion away from the frame of choice. Several Democratic senators hinted that a failure to support Roe v. Wade could be a deal breaker, which means there might be a filibuster. There is a change of language in the works by some pro-choice groups. Pro-choice activists feel they must take a stand on Roberts, so we don't really know what's going to go on with that. The idea is to, I guess, to continue to make it about privacy, individual rights, and personal freedom. Now, NARAL, is that how you say that?
NARAL, yeah.
What is it? I couldn't figure out what the hell it stands for.
National Abortion Rights Action League.
Oh, good. Okay. Because I couldn't figure out. I knew what NARAL was, but I didn't know what it stood for. They issued a statement opposing Roberts, you know, almost immediately before he even announced it on TV. They are feeling the waters out to see if they have Democratic support in a filibuster. Also, apparently, activists have very little faith in Democrats to stand firm on this, and they may not filibuster. But I guess the important thing is how we talk about abortion. Do we talk about, you know, minimizing it? Do we talk about prevention? Do we talk about birth control? What are some of the ways they're trying to reframe this?
There are a number of ways. They talked to our good friend, linguist George Lakoff, about this.
George Lakoff, I think he prefers, so you can't easily mock his name. Because the Lakoff pronunciation would be bad. Right. He had some, you know, he was, I guess, asked to speak to a group of activists, and he made some suggestions. One of them is fairly extreme. He basically states that choice, the idea of choice, comes from a consumer's vocabulary, and that life comes from the moral vocabulary, and that he advised these activists to reclaim the life issue by blaming Republicans for high U.S. mortality rates and mercury pollution that can cause birth defects. Basically, he says that conservatives are killing babies. He said, focus on reducing unwanted pregnancies, and those groups talk about, and the groups that talk about personal freedom, because this resonated during the whole Terri Schiavo thing. And that seems to be the thrust of a lot of this, is to say, you know, to minimize conversation about abortion per se, and to start focusing on prevention and education.
And what it also does is seemingly bow to the notion that a majority of Americans, for example, and we saw this when we talked about the Quinnipiac poll last week, a majority of Americans, a narrow majority, support, for example, the idea of a 24-hour waiting period before an abortion, the idea of parental notification, some of these things that the right and the anti-choice people have been nibbling at the margins with. But what apparently people are trying to go after here is this broad group in the middle that support the concept of personal freedom as far as reproducing is concerned, but does have some question about when it should be allowed, and there should be some instances where it's not allowed.
So is this a move towards the center again around a very important issue to democratic values, which is reproductive freedom and individual rights around this issue? Is it a move towards the center, or is it a practical reframing in order to put the democratic message out to people that may not be hearing it quite right? That is the question. 866-303-2270 is our phone number. Call us and pipe in on this, because we're going to be discussing it more in a few minutes, and we'd like to hear your views. 866-303-2270 is the number, and we'll talk to you in a second about the abortion discussion for the Democrats. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
And you're looking at some rescuers on the rocks beside a rapidly moving river. On the right-hand part of your screen, you'll see the object of their attention right now, which is a woman, there you go, stuck in the rocks there with her pooch. We presume it's her pooch. Maybe she went to rescue the dog. We don't know the full story just yet, but they're attempting to figure out how to safely get pooch and woman safely to shore there. And anyway, now the woman is on her way to safety. We don't know the circumstances that ended with them being in the middle of that raging rapids on the rocks as the dog came off the rocks. Didn't want a dog paddle there very well, did he? Looks like a shepherd mix, maybe. And that's what you just saw, right here, live on CNN. No story too small or too large for us.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
35 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're talking about framing the choice discussion debate for the future of the Democratic Party in the 06 and 08 elections. NARAL, Pro-Choice America, pollster from there, tested a prevention-first agenda that sought to reduce unwanted pregnancies through better birth control and the access to the morning after pill. The pollster said this, quote, will help counter the widespread view that pro-choice groups are extreme and militant. She also declared that, quote, the culture of freedom and responsibility frame soundly beats the culture of life frame. And also, this is coming around the third way. A centrist Democratic think tank said that they have divided voters into what they call abortion polars, those at each extreme, one to keep it legal, one to make it illegal without argument, and abortion grays, who believe that abortion should be mostly legal or mostly illegal. They found that Democrats are losing ground among the grays, even though more of them lean pro-choice. Howard Dean met with Democrats for Life. After the meeting, he expressed he didn't want to change the Democratic position. He wanted to reframe it. He said he wanted to take abortion out of the political lexicon, and there are many people moving to take choice out of the political lexicon. So now we're going to hear from you what this means in terms of the Supreme Court nomination and also in terms of the dialogue Democrats now have around abortion. And by the way, Mort Mortensen is back from vacation. He will be doing Morning Remembrance shortly. Bob in Columbus, Ohio, how are you?
Hey, Bob.
Well, good morning, Mark. And Mark, how are you?
All
good,
right.
Good.
I'm a strategist in Ohio, and let me just say that I know this will help the Democrats, and here's why.
If Roe v. Wade is overturned?
Yes.
Okay.
What I believe would happen is that it will expand what has been George W.'s election issue into an economic issue that really denigrates middle and lower income people, because abortions will be legal. You can go across the state line, whatever money you have to get there, and the gal that gets knocked up by the country club tennis pro can afford to go, but everybody else has to stay home because they can't pay the cost.
Right.
When that happens, it's going to be another illustration of what the neocon right wing have done to America and what they're doing to abolish the middle class. And I feel that it's going to be two points quickly. I think in 2006 it's going to be musical chairs in the House of Representatives. Look at Bill Frist and his flip-flop. And then add Hillary in 2008. And, Bucky, you got a winner.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Bob.
He's not alone in thinking that Democrats could actually be helped by Roe v. Wade being overturned, in that then, as he points out, people's wrath would be focused on the folks that put John Roberts, assuming he's confirmed, on the Supreme Court and allowed that to happen.
So you're saying that it would galvanize Democrats and would bring in people that were on the fence, you know, in terms of, you know, certainly the bet is that, you know, women would come in and more, you know, open-minded and practical conservatives. I don't know. It seems like a hell of a gamble. I mean, I think it's at this point, it is a way to sort of, you know, look at that possibility and rationalize it in our direction. I hope that what you're saying is true. I mean, overturning it has been a cornerstone for the Republicans for years. I've been actually doing it. You know, I'll tell you, I mean, I would hope that it is what we assume it is, which is it's just their way to pander to the religious right, you know, in order to keep them on the in the base and energizing the base. That's how they got the religious right to begin with.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether or not they actually serve these people with this thing, I don't know. I hope it doesn't behoove them to do that. I really do politically hope that it does not behoove them to do that.
Well, the other thing that's scary about this is that while it may be to a political advantage for Democrats, it's going to be an extraordinary hardship for women in America,
yes,
to have to deal with Roe v. Wade being overturned.
It's horrible because it would open the door to all the horrendous nightmare scenarios of having to get, you know, unsafe medical treatment for anything, you know, let alone abortions. You know, it just to open that door up again.
Yeah.
Is horrendous, and it shows a complete disrespect for women on behalf of this administration. Bo, listening in Florence, Alabama on XM, how are you?
Hey, Bo.
Hey, how you doing? I find this debate quite interesting. First of all, abortion, can we at least agree that 90% of them are not rape or incest? They're choices. People choose to do it so they don't have to deal with the consequences of their actions.
That's not true. I don't think that's true.
Okay, can we say 80%? Can you say more than 50%?
I don't know if there's a percentage, but I think that, you know, whether or not why they choose it is not really the issue we're talking about. We're talking about whether or not that they should have access to decent medical health. I mean, judging someone on a moral level in this particular instance is not really at the crux of the issue, is it?
Well, the crux of the issue is the Democrats are losing, and they don't understand the crux of the issue. This is like, first of all, this would be the equipment on the other side of this would be like Christian conservatives trying to distance themselves from Jesus. The Democrats are not going to distance themselves. If you see Hillary, she is running like Mark Furman at the Million Man March. So far away from this, you can't. This has been the crux of the Democratic Party for 40 years.
Yeah, but I don't see her as running. I've seen that there is an attempt to make it understandable. I think that the change in the image of what being an activist for choice looks like is what's really going on here. And if we can start talking about it in terms of medical treatment and in terms of individual rights, freedom to have access to medical treatment that isn't dangerous to them, there's no running. I think it's just trying to reinvent the discussion.
But the moral issue that you'd like to sweep under the rug, that is the issue for the voter.
Now, see, this is something that...
All right, thanks for your call, Bo.
Bo has brought up that is very important. We talked about it a little bit last week, that the people who are opposed to abortion in this country make moral judgments about the people who have them.
Right.
They are saying, in essence, they are running away from something. They are doing something that is immoral by having an abortion, and that is, in my judgment, it is the idea that they refuse to pay for promiscuity, because a lot of people who oppose abortion believe that it is as a result of promiscuity.
Hey, look, you know, to be honest with you, if you look at the number of abortions in terms of just, you know, accidents, there can be condom accidents, there can be, you know, timing accidents. The thing is that they should make it available and make it safe, and even the morning after pill. I mean, these are, you know, these are middle class, you know, just regular people that you have accidents. You can't afford to follow through with this pregnancy or what have you. It's not an issue of, you know, of, to me, you know, whether it's a baby or not.
Oh, no, I know. But see, the religious right frames it in the context of a moral choice that you make to have sex. That's why they push abstinence only so hard.
Right, and they also use the unborn in the same way that the Nazis use the Aryan ideal, that, you know, this is something to fight for to the death, is this idea of the unborn, which really, up until a certain point, the unborn is just a sort of a knot of cells that, you know, doesn't represent anything but possibility. Here we go. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. How are you?
Hi, Paula.
Hey, guys, it's nice to get a woman on for this, huh?
Yeah, it's about time. What's going on?
Well, first of all, about that first guy, strategist who said Roe v. Wade, no, not good.
Mm.
It'll give right-wing nuts, like the other caller you had, 50 states.
Yeah,
I
think they're speculating in terms of, you know, looking at the worst case scenario, and I understand with you, because my original instinct was like, yes, that's absolutely true, but also what we're seeing is that there's a possibility that this extreme faction of the Republican Party, the religious right, has a bigger mouth than they do have a bigger sort of majority of votes. And I think that, you know, it scares me too, Paula.
And how about, as a second point, a reframing issue?
Mm-hmm.
How about like the NRA, like the NUA, National Uterus Association?
Well, you know, Paula,
I don't want to wait 24 hours for a gun.
Uh-huh,
yeah,
that's right.
It's an interesting
24-hour waiting period to make a decision that I've already made.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. But you know what? And I think we have to, when we look at this discussion, we have to be very clear about two things. Overturning Roe v. Wade is not the same as outlawing abortion. If you overturn Roe versus Wade, in order for abortion to be outlawed, the House and Senate have to pass a law that outlaws abortion.
Thanks for your call, Paul.
In other words, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it goes back to the states. There is no federal prohibition against abortion. And this is one point that a lot of people who don't, you know, who think that Roe v. Wade would be a boon to the Democrats, because they then say that Republicans, if they really want to outlaw abortion, will have to pass a law and go on record as outlawing abortion. And they think that would drive people to the Democrats for a generation.
Yeah, well, then there's your scenario. That's the worst and best case scenario. That's our biggest fear being, you know, turned into our biggest, benefit. Sure, yeah. That's it. Well, but you know, the issue is, like, even like in the joke that Paul was making, the National Uterus Association, this is the type, on some level, some of these Democrats want to take the language, the medical language, you know, abortion, uterus, choice. They want to take all that language out and make it specifically about prevention, education, and birth control.
You know, see, my thing is, you got to start drawing lines here. There are already bills, one in New Hampshire and I believe one somewhere else, that would not have a health exception, for example, in parental notification laws.
And also, like she said, if there is no law that makes you wait 24 hours for a gun, why should you wait 24? Why should you have to wait 24 hours
for an abortion? Yeah.
For the pill, you know, for the abortion pill.
Oh, for the morning after.
Morning. See, I use it again. It's very easy. The morning after pill.
Yeah. Well, see, the morning after, some people have a problem with that particular frame because, again, it brings up that aura of promiscuity. What were you doing the night before that you need something the morning after?
What the hell difference does it make to you?
But, see, that's the whole point. For guys like Bo from Alabama, it does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It makes a difference what you do in your bedroom to him.
Why?
Because that's the frame that they've taken.
Because
he can't have an abortion.
They're in a certain amount of denial about that. It seems that everybody, that, you know, part of this biblical legacy of the Christian right and everything else is about forgiveness. It's about understanding. It's about people screwing around on their significant others. It's about people getting into trouble. This is what humans do. They just don't like the solution. They think that as punishment, you should follow that pregnancy all the way through, have an unwanted child, and then see if it turns out okay. As punishment, that should be what you have to do, as opposed to, you know, take care of it before it becomes, you know, another, you know, human, unwanted human being in the world. But see, that's what they see as fodder for them. They collect unwanted people, and they baptize them, and they make good Christians.
Absolutely. And they really have a problem with the term unwanted.
Okay. Well, we're going to have Morning Remembrance, you know, coming up after this. It's been a very engaging conversation. Thank you for your calls. It's 47 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python. And if you're like me, you're tired of having geeks and dorks repeat things you said 30 years ago back to you as if you don't remember saying them and then laughing as they think they're so damn clever. I mean, wow, you memorized a 30-year-old movie? Oh, good show, old chap. Oh, great. Be president of the United States. Come on. And now for something completely different. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Fifty-two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We'll be broadcasting live from the legendary CBGBs in Manhattan this Friday. We're going to have Stephen Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos. We got comedian Jim Gaffigan. We got some live rock music, free coffee, 6 to 9 CBGBs this Friday. Come
on. Is the Cardinal
down.
Coming?
I believe he is.
Oh.
Unfortunately, folks, it's time. It's that time of week again when we hear it. We hear it. Morning Sedition. Take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
You all right?
Hi.
Yeah, welcome back.
Hi.
What's up, guys?
How are you?
We're all right, man.
You all right?
I'm all right. I got some sort of congestion.
Really? Maybe you picked up something when you were on your trip.
Yeah.
Down northern Carolina.
Yeah.
Northern Carolina. Who?
Let's get on with this. Chet Helms, father of the summer of love. Chet Helms, father of San Francisco's 1967 Summer of Love and leader of that decade's hippie culture, finally got back to the land this month when he was buried in it. Authorities say the renowned promoter of hippie philosophy and psychedelic light shows was found alone in his house, sprawled on the ceiling. You ever chopping any nutmeg?
Yeah, we had a guy demonstrating how to chop nutmeg in here just minutes ago.
Really?
Yeah. You need a Kleenex or something?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, buddy.
Oh, that.
Okay, buddy.
Among other things, Mark.
Yeah.
Helms is famous for persuading Janis Joplin to move to San Francisco in 1962, changing the face of music forever, as well as precipitating the great San Francisco smack shortage of 1963.
Are you allergic to smack?
Yeah. You've been smoking clove cigarettes in here?
Yeah, a lot of that. The guy that's chopping nutmeg brought clove cigarettes in. We told him he couldn't smoke them.
Why do you have that?
I don't know. It's a weird show.
Weird show. You're telling me he's crazy. Nutty. Doctors said the cause of death was attributed to repetitive stress injuries directly related to, quote, years of helping kids fly their freak flags. moving on.
Yeah, let's do it.
William Westmoreland, Vietnam War general. William Westmoreland, the controversial general who commanded this country's military during the Vietnam War, died last month at the age of 91. In other words, he finally saw the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
Sure, that joke's been done a million times. It's not a joke.
Right.
Soft-spoken yet strong-willed, a highly disciplined Westmoreland represented the ideal image of an American military leader. Unfortunately, that American military leader was George Custer.
Yeah. Oh, you gonna be all right? Okay, man.
Even sprayed myothylon.
Yeah, a lot of that, too. They're doing it everywhere.
A lot of mosquitoes here.
Yeah.
Born to upper-class parents in South Carolina, Westmoreland was able to take the lessons learned from his state's pointlessly tragic losses during the Civil War and completely ignore them during the Vietnam War. According to one biographer, Westmoreland loved ice cream and liked to drink 2 gin and tonics every night, a habit that not only explains him seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, but throwing up in one as well. The deceased requested his body be cremated, and his ashes dropped into a humiliating quagmire. I'm allergic to mire.
Yeah? What is mire?
I don't know. It usually goes with quag.
Oh, it's it. But oh, so it's not. Okay.
You know, like what we're doing now is a quagmire. Okay? Anyway, this has been this week's Mort in Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying. It's chopping onions.
Nice to have you back, Mort.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll be at Spastics in Arlington.
That's weird, because Saturday I'll be at Giggles in Seattle.
Well, we should see each other.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's that going to happen?
I don't know. You know, telecommute or something.
So where did you have a good vacation? Did you visit any grave sites?
Went to some Civil War monuments. Oh. A couple of Confederate monuments.
That's interesting. Yeah.
In Washington, D.C.
You were in Washington, D.C., the country's capital.
Yes.
And he was part of his slavery was noble tour.
Mm.
What? Wait, you're going to cut us off right there?
Coming back, we've got Stephen Page, the lead singer of the Canadian rock band The Bare Naked Ladies, going to play for a solo in studio. He's got a new record coming out. Stay with us. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Air America Radio, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, folks. Riley, how you doing, all right?
I'm doing great, man.
We're going to talk about moving in just a second.
Oh, you know, no, not that.
You're moving, man, and yeah. I know a lot of people are doing it right now, and it's like, what a pain in the arse. Anyways, Stephen Page from the Bare Naked Ladies is going to be in here performing solo in studio. He's got a new album coming out, The Vanity Project, and he's going to play a couple of songs on his guitar. I'm looking forward to that. 2 protruding pieces of heat-resistant fabric on the underside of the shuttle, the space shuttle, are causing enough concern that astronauts are considering an in-flight repair that would require a spacewalk. Dude, I can't even, like, I freak out when I have to fix my toilet. Can you imagine this? Like, I can't even imagine what those guys are going through. I'm freaking out just thinking about it. You're up in space, it's like, who wants to go? Who wants to go out there and fix this? Apparently, the flight director of the 114th shuttle mission said an engineering team of aeroheating specialists are expected to decide whether or not an astronaut should go out into space with a hacksaw and fix the shuttle. A hacksaw. That's hilarious to me. It's like, what's in the toolbox? Give me that. Is that a hacksaw? Will that cut metal? Let me have that thing. And is there pliers in there? No pliers. You got a Leatherman tool? All right, I'll bring that out with me.
You know, this is everyone's worst case scenario. How many science fiction movies have there been where somebody's gone out in space attached to some kind of cable or something, and suddenly the cable snaps and they drift off into space with this look of horror on their face? How many movies has that been in?
Oh, yeah, it's been in quite a few, Riley.
Exactly.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll bet you that's what they think. Say, hey, look, we'll have to draw straws to see who goes out there.
Oh, man, I hope not. I hope everything works out. I don't think we can afford another disaster with a shuttle. It'd just be too disturbing. Bush will appoint, this is like, you know, this is from sources, you know, I don't know if it's going to really happen, but Bush will appoint John Bolton despite the fact that no one likes likes him or wants him, and that it's, you know, this guy's got no respect for democracy whatsoever, George Bush and John Bolton, for that matter. Bush intends to exercise a rarely used constitutional power to appoint John Bolton as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. This is a temporary appointment, but don't let that fool you. It's a temporary appointment till January 2007. So this ass is going to be in there till 2007. Trent Lott doesn't even want him in there. The fact that no one likes him and that he didn't have the support of the Senate will weaken his position in the U.N. and in certainly among politicians in this country. But, you know, this guy is an ass. And George Bush is an ass for overriding anything, any sort of debate, any sort of question of anything he does. It's selfish. It's stubborn. It's belligerent. I don't like it, Riley.
Let me tell you something. The question that a lot of people in and around the United Nations are asking is, how much damage can this guy do between tomorrow and January of 2007? And the answer to that question is a hell of a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Of
this
course.
Is a guy who said you could, you know, blow away 10 floors of the United Nations and it would make absolutely no difference. So you might want to ask yourself, why would he want the job in the first place? But now Bush is prepared to backdoor him in, which means that everybody in the United Nations is going to totally ignore everything he says because they know that America's legislature did not have a hand in putting the man there.
Exactly. I have a sort of weird, reinvigorated contempt for Michael Bloomberg, our mayor here in New York City. It's weird, you know, because, you know, we had Fernando Ferrer, you know, on our show. Nice guy, decent guy. You know, definitely among the working people, Mr. Ferrer is he not? And then I read this piece about Michael Bloomberg. He's worth $5 billion. He's the nation's wealthiest politician. He has spent $23 million already on his campaign and is going to top his 2001 total of $74 million. That's $100 per voter in this area. Fernando Ferrer pointed out that the mayor's campaign costs this summer alone will equal the pay, the salaries of thousands of teachers. He's trying to play the part, Michael Bloomberg is, fewer ski trips, more church picnics, Little League games, ethnic parades. And most working people see right through it, and this is going to be the hedge. This is going to be the big criticism coming into this campaign.
It is going to be the big criticism because it seems to be the only criticism of Mike Bloomberg that has legs. When you look at the polling, a lot of New Yorkers, including a lot of New Yorkers that might not ordinarily love the guy, seem to love the guy. The crime rate's down, education is doing better, et cetera, et cetera. But the notion that he's out of touch with the needs and concerns of ordinary people has always been his Achilles heel since the day he was sworn in. And right now, the Democrats are trying to figure out how they can exploit it.
And do you think they will be able to exploit it with any success, Mark Riley?
I'm not so sure in this instance. Mike Bloomberg has built up an extraordinary reservoir of goodwill. When you read in the paper, as I did last week, that Fernando Ferrer was losing support among Latinos to Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah.
You say to yourself, wow, I mean, could this guy really? Now, right now they're seeing polling, we see polls that say he's like 16 points up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect that to last.
Right.
By the time we get to November, Mike Bloomberg is going to be in a tough single-digit race with whoever the Democrat is. The question is that Democrat going to be able to Velcro any issue to this mayor that can cause his defeat?
Well, you're always the one who's telling me that, saying that you never know what's going to happen with these kind of things.
That's exactly the point.
You know, because when we talked to, Fernando Ferrer, and we've talked to a couple other of the candidates.
Anthony Weiner, Gifford Miller, Virginia Fields.
They just keep pushing because you don't know what can happen. You don't know what people really think. That's the interesting thing about politics, is that you've got a lot of money on this guy's side, and you've got a lot of people with money on this guy's side, and a lot of people, buying the sort of bill of goods that he was responsible for for the education jump and for everything else. But when it comes right down to it, it's going to be voters. It's going to be working people who are going to make that judgment either 2 days before or a day before. Who the hell knows when?
Well, yeah, and that's the important part, Mark. Not every voter makes up their mind in September what they're going to do in November.
That's for
but
sure.
But what Mike Bloomberg did say to New Yorkers early in his mayoralty was, judge me primarily on my education agenda and how well kids are doing in school. And on that measure alone, he wins.
And if you don't want to judge me on that, here's $15. Did that do it? How
no,
about 20?
$100. I'm holding out for the full Monty here.
Make it $1.50. You want to go in? He can't do anything about the heat. I just read that this has been like, it's looking like the hottest summer ever for the Eastern Seaboard. And I haven't felt it really. I mean, I know it's been bad, but I've remembered in my life being more irritated by, you know why? That was before I had an air conditioner.
Ah.
Oh, that makes a difference. Here's an interesting story. John Lennon's handwritten lyrics for the Beatles song All You Need Is Love that was taken from a music stand after the Beatles' last TV appearance sold for $1 million to a private collector. $1 million. The auction took place at London's Hippodrome nightclub and brought in $1.75 million. The tunic he wore during a 1966 Life magazine shoot that was thought to be the inspiration for the Sgt. Pepper's cover went for $175,000.
Wow.
How do you like that? A piano from his New York City apartment went for $245,000. A pair of his glasses went for $97,000. The director of Cooper Owen, the company that held the auction, said that the lyrics of All You Need Is Love is like the holy grail of Beatles memorabilia. But I want to share a little story with you once. I can't even remember where the hell it was. Could it have been in Boston? I'm at a Hard Rock Cafe. I'm walking through, looking at the stuff on the wall. There's a huge table of frat guys just, you know, like playing quarters and eating French fries. And there, right above it, in a beautiful little frame, the handwritten lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine. And it was easy to imagine there was no heaven at that moment. That was certainly...
Who gets the money, by the way?
I don't know where that money goes. I was going to ask you that because, like, you hear about these auctions. Is Yoko,
I assume she controls his estate, I believe. So
probably
yeah,
did she put this up for auction? Does the money come back to her? It must be her. I don't know if there's a charity involved that wasn't in the research that I had. I'll look into it, though, Riley.
No, we both got to look into it because I'm curious.
Well, then we got something to do while we wait to come back and we wait to hear from, we got the lead singer of the Bare Necked Ladies. Bare Necked? Naked. I said it like a Southerner. Stephen Page, lead singer of the Bare Necked Ladies, is going to be here to play some music in a little while. And also, you're moving, and I got a bad. If you're thinking about choosing U-Haul, I say no, and I'll tell you why in a second. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Team past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
That you're listening to right now is Stephen Page, the lead singer of the Canadian rock band The Bare Necked Ladies. That's his album, The Vanity Project, which is out now. He'll be here to play for us in just a second. He'll be at Borders Wall Street, 100 Broadway at noon today for an in-store performance and CD signing, and he's going to be here with us. This is a big day for Stephen.
Yeah.
So, Riley, the big move day is when?
The big move day is tomorrow.
Oh, my God, I'd be freaking out. You seem awfully calm, but you're always calm. I've never noticed you to freak out about anything. Maybe once, but it was...
Well, when it comes to moving, I don't freak out because I let somebody else do it.
So you hired a guy. See, the thing is like, I did that once when I moved from New York to San Francisco, I think, the first time. And there are so many scams. We got so screwed over. That was when I was with my first wife, and she, thank God, both women I've been married to love to engage and get things. Like, they love, if there's a problem, they will call up and they will be like, dude, we need this fixed now, and they will get it done. But I found that my experience with Mayflower was bad, and I don't mean to bring up brand names, but everyone I've ever talked to has had stuff moved, has gotten screwed somehow. You didn't?
No.
Not yet. You don't know yet.
Yeah. When we moved from New York out to Jersey, we didn't get screwed. My wife takes care of all that. She's just like wives in terms of, you know, she's the one that makes the phone call. She's the one that you know, badgers and cajoles and has people over for the
estimate. Isn't that great?
I ignore all of it. It is great.
I'm Dan Pashman. Hey, guys. I'm actually the guy who makes the calls. On Saturday, I was moving helping my girlfriend move, excuse me, and U-Haul called us up the day before the move. And said, oh, yeah, that reservation you have for a truck that you had from the last 2 weeks.
Worthless.
We might not have a truck for you.
This is the problem with U-Haul. These are all franchises. They're just gas stations. Like, if you have a U-Haul franchise and you're a gas station, that just means, you know, trucks come through there.
Right.
You don't care about them. This is what happened to me, man.
I want to hear this.
You do?
Yeah.
When I was moving down, when we were moving out to California, I rented a big U-Haul, one of the big ones. There were 19-foot or 27-foot was the biggest one, but the second from the biggest U-Haul, right? We load it all up with everything we got. We rented it at the one, it was at a gas station, that U-Haul franchise out here in Long Island City or somewhere. So we go pick up the truck. We load up the truck. We're driving. It's raining. It's horrendous. It's at night. She's following me in my Honda because I didn't want to hook it up to the car because we had Butch, the cat. But this is hilarious. We didn't want to get a cat trailer. And we didn't want to get a trailer for the car because where would we put Butch? Butch needs air conditioner. Right. We wanted Butch to be comfortable. So we drove the Honda behind the truck. So now, all right, about we're coming into Pennsylvania, and my wife, we had walkie-talkies, and we both had handles and stuff. She's like, hey, Big Daddy, what's going on? You know, because we wanted to talk to each other without using cell phones, so we bought walkie-talkies. All right, anyways, that aside, she calls me up. She's like, hey, Big Daddy, and I'm like, yeah, what's up, trickster? You know, and then she goes, something just blew up in the back of the truck. I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, there was a cloud of smoke or something. I'm like, are you sure? She's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. And I'm like, I don't feel anything. It seems okay. She's like, I'm not going to worry about it. All right, fine. So then she's like, We parked the car to get gas, and I look at the car, and it still doesn't dawn on me, Dan. I look at the car, and for some reason, the car is covered with this film of black goo.
Oh, yes.
So, but I didn't make any connections. I'm like, what happened to the car? Did you drive through an oil storm? How the hell? Why is your car all covered with grease? And she's like, I don't know what's going on. I'm like, that's crazy. There must have been something on the road. What, am I an idiot? All right. So we finally get, you know, we just keep driving. I am amazed that it made it this far because I had no idea what was wrong with it. And finally the car starts to make a smell and a sound and there's smoke and stuff. And we pull over. We are in Rolla, Missouri. It made it to Rolla, Missouri. And I look under the car. I'm still not sure what the hell's wrong with it yet. But I look under the U-Haul and there's an axle. There's like, it was the rear axle is dripping goop.
Right?
It's just like dripping
goop. Not a good sign.
Yeah, but I don't know that. I don't know about cars. So I'm thinking, like, that's supposed to be like that. You know?
You're supposed to dribble oil across America.
Yeah, with trucks, they lube up the axles. All right, so here's what happens. I call U-Haul. This is the killer. Yeah. I call U-Haul, and I can't control myself. And, you know, I'm like, you know, hi. They put you through about three different things, and then finally get hold of Emerging Road Service. And I'm like, I'm in Missouri, and I got it. And then all of a sudden, click, and I'm like, what the hell is that?
Oh, that's the worst.
So I call back, and I'm like, you don't understand, you idiots. I'm in Missouri. What the hell am I going to do? I had to be in L.A. in 2 days to be at a meeting at Fox. For a TV deal. So I was on a time frame.
Right.
The Friday before Labor Day. Would it be Labor Day? Yes, Labor Day. Friday before Labor Day. We're in Rolla, Missouri. Here's what U-Haul says after six calls where I learned that customer service is not paid to take your crap. If they don't want to, they will hang up on you. All right? So they get a local tow truck to tow us to a tow yard. That guy says, we can't fix this. It had blown a gasket. There was a wrong valve. So the thing that the gears kind of turn in on the middle of the axle,
They're
all ground to nothing. You can't drive the car.
Ooh.
There's no U-Haul truck in the area. U-Haul says, we think there's a truck 45 miles away. You can go get it. The gas station is closed, but the key should be in it. So we drive to this place. It's the middle of the South. You know, we don't even know. Like, the place where the address was like an old gas station where there's just buckets of, like, you know, oil and entrails there and, like, dead cars. And across the street, there was a U-Haul. I'm like, I guess that's it. So meanwhile, people are sort of looking out their windows. And I get into the cab of this truck, and I'm like, dude, what if we get pulled over? What am I going to do? They said to U-Haul, we could take this truck. So now I'm looking at
me. I swear, officer, they said it was okay.
They said it was okay.
Exactly.
So mine is broken down 45 miles away.
Right. So I said, we can't take this truck. And it didn't look like it was going to make it either. And I swear to God, we were in trouble. And we were at this tow yard. And they were being real nice and everything. But I'm freaking out because I got to be in L.A. And it looked like we might be in Rolla, Missouri over the long weekend.
Oh, God.
No, and it's coming up on 5 o'clock. And everything's going to be closed for the long weekend. And some miracle. The U-Haul across town, someone drove a 27-footer in, and we were like, you know, we got on it. We called the guy, hold it, and we come over there, and we hired two guys. The guy who worked at the tow yard, his name was BJ, all right?
I wonder how he got that name.
Yeah, and, well, no, he's got, you know, they all have nicknames in the South. Is that generalizing?
Bobby Joe.
Well, he calls his friend, CJ, who comes down, and we pay them $50 to take all the stuff out of our truck and put it in the other truck, and then we get going again. But it was horrendous. Horrendous. And now I got a bigger truck and I'm driving a semi and she's...
Those things are hard to drive.
Yeah. Right?
They're real hard. But yeah, U-Haul is the worst, man. They screwed us over this weekend. And I almost had a U-Haul going from Chicago to New York when I moved out here until a friend of mine told me he had a U-Haul and the brakes failed in his truck. So I switched to Penske.
That's the thing is that they don't the upkeep. If they were actually U-Haul garages, all these franchises, they just do what they have to do to maintain the cars at the least possible level. Like they literally somebody put the wrong part into this axle,
right?
You know, because it's like, well, hell with it, we got to get it out of here and keep it moving. So there's no way to sort of oversee the maintenance of these vehicles when they're dealt with franchises, and that's a real problem.
Somewhere in New York City, an Air America salesman is going, heaving.
There goes the U-Haul.
There goes
thing.
The U-Haul account.
Well, then we should go after Penske. I endorse Penske.
Folks, we're going to be back with Stephen Page from the Bare Naked Ladies to perform for us in studio. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, it's Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. To remind you, we'll be broadcasting live from the legendary CBGBs in Manhattan this Friday. We have little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos. He's scheduled to appear, plus comedian Jim Gaffigan, live rock music, free coffee, the regular stuff, giveaway 6 to 9 CBGBs this weekend. We're going to have some live music right now. Our next guest is best known as the lead singer for the rock band The Bare Naked Ladies. His first solo album, The Vanity Project, came out earlier this summer. He'll be at Borders Wall Street at 100 Broadway at noon today for an in-store performance and CD signing, and he joins us live in the studio this morning. Welcome to the show, Stephen Page. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. Good morning.
So The Vanity Project, I enjoyed the record. Can I call it a record? Can you still
can.
Do that?
Call them records.
You do? It's,
there you
it's
go.
Weird. It's, I guess it's an aging. You call them records still?
Yeah.
I thought it was great. I thought it was poppy. It was fun. It was nice. It's a great record. Why the title Vanity Project?
Well, because for a few things. I knew that as soon as I stepped out of the comfort zone of Bare Naked Ladies, somebody would call it a vanity project anyway, so I had
that's
to be
yeah.
confined. And you know what? A few things. One thing is what the songs are about, which is in a lot of ways, vanity, whether it's vanity of our culture, vanity of men, and whatever else. But it's also about what is the point sometimes of standing in front of an audience and singing? When you start making music for other people, some of that is about your own vanity. And,
oh, my
and
God. I ask myself all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do comedy. I ask myself all the time. Have you had those moments on stage where you're looking out at the people and just like,
yeah, or why am I here and not just at home curled up in a ball?
So are those answers on the album then?
I think the questions are explored on the album. Whether there's answers or not, I don't know.
So now, do the other guys in the band, when you said you were going to do your vanity project or your solo project, were they like, dude, what's that about?
Yeah, a little bit. But it's also, this is a product of a songwriting collaboration with an English guy named Stephen Duffy that I've been writing with for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I have been writing songs for Bare Naked Ladies for years, and then there was a point about 2000 where we realized we have four really good songwriters in the band as it is, and in order to keep the band sustainable, we've been together for 17 years, we really need to exploit that songwriting partnership within the band and not be bringing stuff in from outside to compete for space. So as soon as we kind of decreed that, I realized I had an opportunity to make this record outside of the band because these songs weren't going to compete for a place on B&L Records.
So this really has the effect of keeping the band together? Because, I mean, it's rare, I think maybe in jazz in a couple of instances, where you have a really solid group that's been together for a while, and then they start individual projects, and then they actually do come back together and do something else in the future. In most cases, that doesn't happen.
No, you see it fracture all the time because you see those things compete with each other. But I think as long as we focus on trying to make Bare Naked Ladies a community, because we the other guys in the band, the bass player and the keyboard player, made lots of solo records on the side. You know, Ed, our other singer, does acting and things. We all do things on the side. If we can consider that all part of the same.
Have you thought about buying land, maybe a retreat of some kind, and invited other people and make an actual commune to
Bare Naked Ladies? I have thought about it. I built a little studio on a farm there. I thought I could just spend all day naked wife swapping.
Oh, whoa. Wait
there
a
you
minute.
Go. Let us know when you get that website together and you actually have the property, and we'll help you plug that as well. So on the now a lot of people have you obviously have a lot of pop influences. A lot of people have described the CD as sounding have resonance of the Cars, REM, Paul McCartney. Who are your people? Who are your guys? Who are the templates in the back of your head from your childhood?
Well, the templates are definitely the Beatles. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the obvious one. And from this record, we took a lot of cues from the first McCartney solo record, which is
Ram.
You know, the one before that, McCartney one, the old Cherries one, but also Ram. Those two records have that really homespun feel that, you know, this is a homemade record. We made this in my basement, and it you know, we took our inspiration from that. But also people like Harry Nilsson is a big hero of mine, or Randy Newman. But then growing up, artists like the Smiths were definitely important to me
That's a great combination that's going to come through you in moments.
I hope it kind of seeps through the song somewhere.
So this song you're going to do is called...
It's called Wilted Rose.
And that's about...
It's about the... In 2001, we had in Quebec City... I'm from Canada. In Quebec City, they had the Summit of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think Canadians think of themselves as some kind of a different breed. And it was a moment where, for a lot of us, where we realized that we're no different from anybody else from the way... In the way that we were treating our own citizens, the way we were treating protesters at that summit. And the fact that we were willing to subvert our own... our own values in order to impress foreign finance ministers.
The imperial powers.
Well, exactly. And sure. That's the stuff that we, you know, we as Canadians, I think we thought for some reason we were above it, and we're not.
Okay.
And, you know, you grow up with a certain, thinking you have a certain set of values that really are just there for show.
So it was sort of a wake-up call for you.
A little bit, yeah. It was also a bit of a call to arms.
Okay, great. Well, let's hear that song.
Okay. Let me just get my harmonica in place.
All right, I'll give you a second for that.
There you go.
I almost tried to care. They built a wall to protect them from us all. We should have left them there. Revolution is the first to go. Best is forced to stay. Shall I cast this out, this wilted rose? Yeah. No, no, no. Like Pierre Trudeau's walk out in the snow. Can it be time to leave? I spent my youth thinking people spoke the truth. Now it's hard just to think. Was I naive to say I do believe that none of us should sink? They sold us out. And they sold us short. Now we're the ones who have to pay. Shall I cast this out, this wilted rose? Yeah. No, no, no. Like Pierre Trudeau's walk out in the snow. Can it be time to leave? Don't go, you know. It's all the same to me these days, I swear. It's hard to care. Revolution is the first to go. The rest is forced to stay. Shall I cast this out, this wilted rose? Yeah. No, no, no. Like Pierre at Trudeau's walk out in the snow. Can it be time to leave? Don't go, you know. It's all the same to me these days, I swear. It's hard to care.
Yeah.
Stephen Page. The album is The Vanity Project. You can go to www.vanity-project.com for some information. Is there some dates on there for you as well?
Yeah, I've got a few more live dates on this next couple of weeks.
And you've got you're going to be in Boston in a few days?
Boston on Friday.
Great.
Doing, it's Prudential Plaza, Prudential Square, something. Yeah. Prudential Center.
Yeah, that was
at lunchtime.
That was a real protest song, a real revolution song.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for that stuff. I get all weepy with that stuff.
No, I thought it sounded great. Now, when you write, it's weird when you do a protest song or actual a revolution song. Do you think like, well, I gotta do the harp, gotta do the harmonica thing?
You know what? Yes, I think so. a little bit of the Dylan nostalgia comes in.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Now, was that a debate? Was I missing something? Was that a debate with yourself about migrating out of Canada?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the height of the Bare Naked Ladies' success. And, you know, around that time, 2000 and so on, there was I realized I could live anywhere. I could live in the south of France. I could live in New York or LA or wherever I wanted to, London. What's keeping me there? You know, my parents live in Toronto, but otherwise.
Was it the health coverage?
You know, I didn't need that stuff anymore. Yeah,
right.
That's the thing. Like,
there's
a point where I could actually afford
it.
To go private with any of those kinds of things if those options existed.
Sure.
And you realize that there's something worth fighting for, and, you know, you guys have obviously figure that out in the country and you know, around the world. We have to fight for what makes us proud to be where we're from. And you know, we can't in Canada. I think there's such a willingness to talk the talk but never walk the walk, and it's going to lead to disaster.
And you played at the Live 8 concert up there.
We did indeed.
And that was that with the whole band or?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great, man.
Yeah, it was fun. That was a different thing. Here it seemed to kind of float by fairly innocuously. In Canada, I think because musicians were not very vocal during our last election, apart from maybe me. Most people didn't. You know, I think they were just kind of thinking, "God, thank God Bush isn't running," and that was kind of it.
That Stephen Page guy's out on the steps again with his guitar.
Exactly, the harmonica's out. Careful. But so this time with Live 8, this was the opportunity for the mainstream press to say, "Shut up, rock stars! What do you know?" Which I think your press did with the last election.
But yeah, they did that a lot. Yeah,
you know, who are you to tell us about foreign policy and foreign aid and so on? We've thought about economic policy, and we know this is totally not affordable. Although this is something that our government agreed to in 1970 and never followed through on.
So, Stephen Page, you want to hang out and play another song when we come back?
I'd be glad to.
That's great. Stephen Page is our guest, the lead singer of the Bare Naked Ladies. His new CD is The Vanity Project. We're going to have some more music from him in just a second. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
It's even worse than I had feared. Please go away. Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Okay, let's land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Our guest in studio is Stephen Page, the lead singer of the Bare Naked Ladies. His new CD is called The Vanity Project. You can go to www.vanity-project.com for tour dates, information about the record, as we've been calling it. He's going to play us another song from the or which one are you going to play? You can play us a Bare Naked Ladies song or one of yours?
What do you guys want?
Either. I would say, what do you want, Chris? Okay, there you go.
Okay, I'll play this one.
All right.
Mm-hmm. to let me take you home. You were wrong, I was right. You said goodbye, I said goodnight. Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done before I knew you, before the West was won. And I heard you say that the past was much more fun. You go your way, I'll go mine, but I'll see you next time. Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done before. And if I put my fingers here, and if I say I love you, dear, and if I play the same three chords, will you just yawn and say, woo-hoo-hoo, it's all been done. Woo-hoo-hoo, it's all been done. Woo-hoo-hoo, it's all been done before. Alone and bored on a 30th century night, well, I see you on the Price is Right. Will I cry? Will I smile as you run down the aisle? Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done. Ooh, it's all been done before. Ooh, it's all been.
Yeah.
Stephen Page.
Very nice.
The new CD, The Vanity Project, out now. You will be today, you'll be at Borders Wall Street at 100 Broadway at noon today for an in-store performance and CD signing. It was great having you, you know.
Thank you.
And,
thanks for
having me. Great time with the tour. You'll be in Boston on Friday, and we got a lot of listeners up in Boston. What Bare Naked Ladies album was that on?
That was on Stunt, 1998 Stunt.
Well, there you go, because some people are like, well, how do I get that one? And now they know. But thanks for being with us. Appreciate you coming.
Glad to be here.
Last week, the Senate approved longtime Bush buddy Karen Hughes as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy. Her main job is to reverse anti-American sentiment in the world, especially the Muslim world. And hey, job seekers, she's already advertising for a assistance. We found this in the classifieds. It's our Morning's Edition Monday job listing. Wanted, really, really good PR pros. Do you enjoy a challenge? How about a struggle? How about an exercise in futility? Join us in our quest to sell American values to a world of people who think the key to heaven is to kill as many of us as possible. You will be responsible for a U.S. government program to get people to love us after the rest of the resources of the U.S. government are used to torture them to death with sledgehammer handles and attack dogs. Sorry, but Arab Americans are not encouraged to apply. Too much of a security risk. If it sounds impossible, remember, you will be working for a respected professional woman who helped convince the American people to elect the dimwit who got us into this mess in the first place. There you go.
Wait a minute. She's got a job in PR that you have to be confirmed by the Senate for?
Yeah. Oh, look at that. Now it's time for this week's liberal agenda. There's the facts from the Streisand compound giving us a rundown of all our important liberal causes. Here are your marching orders for today. One, proposed National Slacker Day to celebrate Bush's 50th trip to the ranch in 5 years. Two, hold seminars to promote tolerance in people who think they can't tolerate the heat. Three, circulate flyer with a chart detailing how many edgy independent films could be made for the price of the space shuttle. Four, suggest a slogan for the new Al Gore TV network. How about, it's not boring, we promise. Five, phrase of the day, just work this into conversation. I've been watching the London bombing investigation, and apparently it's possible to catch terrorists without invading a completely unrelated country and taking their oil. Wake up, sheeple. Britain ran its investigation with Sherlock Holmes. We ran ours with lobbyists and bombs. That's why we're not catching Bin Laden until it suits Tom DeLay. Wow. That was wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Page.
Yeah.
And thank you, Mark Reilly.
Thank
what do we
you.
Got tomorrow? Mark think, Benjamin?
Yeah, Mark Benjamin.
He's going to talk to us about going to therapy where they tried to Christianize him and make him not gay, even though he might not be gay. I'm not sure. We'll ask him.
Tall order. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.